I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Jack Ewing is the New York Times reporter who covered the Volkswagen fraud scandal. He's written a new book that looks at how the German automaker reached its goal, surpassing Toyota as the world's largest, yet later would end up settling for billions of dollars with American regulators and car owners when the Environmental Protection Agency disclosed that Volkswagen had installed deceiving software that reported down vehicles' emissions. This was a severe blow thanks to the backlash from watchdogs and consumers. So-called green cars weren't really, and this book does a fine job in outlining the deception and the conditions to which this all seemed to flourish. Mr. Ewing goes back to Volkswagen's history, to the Nazi era when it was dubbed the People's Car, through to the post-war era and its break into the American market. The book looks at the management of Volkswagen through the years and looks ahead at where the company is today. Jack Ewing has covered business and economics for the New York Times since 2010. He is based in Frankfurt and has been working in Germany since 1994, including more than 10 years as a correspondent for Business Week. The Twitter handle is @JackEwingNYT. The book is called Faster, Higher, Farther, The Volkswagen Scandal. It's published by W.W. Norton. Please welcome to the Planta Online program from New York City today, Jack Ewing. Mr. Ewing, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
This book is fascinating in that it's there's a lot of stuff that, with regards to the story that's happening even as we speak, and it's a story that has had a great effect on car manufacturing and business around the world. There are two angles, I guess, where we can get into the book, and one. The first would be the market for cars in the world today, and just how Volkswagen has tried, because you point out in the book the history of this company has tried for decades to sell well, and I guess the second thing is just how popular green is and how Volkswagen used this as their hook. To the history of this company and its leadership, it started with a guy named Porsche, but he's not the same Porsche that we know from the other company, right?
Well, there is a connection, because Ferdinand Porsche was the inventor of the Beetle. He was actually one of the great automotive pioneers from the beginning of the 20th century. And then after the war, he was pretty old by then, but his son, whose name was also Ferdinand, and they called him Ferry, he was the one who started Porsche, the car company. And it was a connection with Volkswagen, because the first Porsches were actually Volkswagen chassis and motors, which they souped up and they put a different body on, and that was how Porsche started as a sports car company.
Yeah. How important was it for you, Jack, to talk about the history of Volkswagen, to give us the context of where this company is today, especially when you talk in the book about the Nazi era and the role that Volkswagen that played in its foundation.
Yeah, and I think, I think that the main reason I put it in the book was, one, the Porsche family was involved in Volkswagen one way or another right from the beginning, when Ferdinand Porsche Sr. Built what came to be known as the Beetle for Adolf Hitler. Mm-hmm. And then there was always the connection between the family and Volkswagen down to the present day, although there was many changes in the relationship. And also, I just thought it was an interesting history. It's very kind of unique in the car world that you have a company that was actually basically a Nazi startup and then bombed during the war. They never actually built many Beetles before or during the war. And then afterwards, it was actually a British officer who saw this funny-looking car in the rubble and said, you know, what's that, and got the factory producing it again. And then that was the beginning of what we know Volkswagen as today, which basically neck and neck with Toyota is the largest car company in the world. Yeah. I don't think you can... Sorry, go ahead.
No, so what I wanted to know is about... because you mentioned being a Nazi startup. I guess Hitler had an idea of what he wanted from Volkswagen, right? Or what he wanted the Volkswagen to be as part of, the habits of German drivers.
Yeah, well, that German Germans actually, Carl Benz was actually invented, is considered the inventor of the automobile, but it was actually Henry Ford over in the United States who figured out a way to mass produce it and make it affordable for the middle classes. And in Germany in the 30s, when the Nazis came to power, practically no one actually owned a car. You had to be rich. And so his idea was, let's make a car that everybody can afford. Of course, that was never realized until after the war. But that was the basic idea. And in a way, that is still kind of the core idea behind Volkswagen, was technology, automobile technology that's relatively affordable for average buyers. And that's still what they try to do today.
When did they break into the United States? I mean, and I guess the Beetle, was that the first thing that they brought over?
Yeah, and that would happen pretty quickly. I mean, the Beetle was a hit almost from the beginning because it was, you know, cheap, easy to fix, not very simple, and very quickly they started exporting them around Europe and then to the United States. And in the U.S. it became kind of a counterculture thing. There was the whole 60s movement, and the Beetle appealed to that generation precisely because it was simple. You could work on it yourself. It was cheap. And back in the 60s, the Beetle was actually the best-selling import in the United States. This was before Toyota or Nissan, the Japanese car makers, had really come in a big way. And part of the reason Volkswagen got into trouble later is that they never could figure out how to recreate the success that they had in the 60s, and eventually went too far in trying to do that again.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that in a sec, but I mean, you know, you remember the photograph, and you have it in the book, of Janis Joplin
right.
in that Beetle. And mm-hmm. So that was the apex, was it, in terms of sales for Volkswagen in the United States?
Yeah. Yeah, they still, to this day, have never sold as many cars in the United States as they did. And I can't remember the exact year, but around 1968 was the peak. I think it was close to 700,000 cars. And nowadays, they're lucky to sell 300,000 or so.
Yeah. What were sales like in Germany? I mean, is Volkswagen, or are they the most popular car there in that country?
Yeah, by far and away. And not only Germany, but all of Europe, Volkswagen is by far the biggest car maker. About their market share has slipped a bit because of the scandal, but uh-huh. About a quarter of the market in Europe is Volkswagen. Not only Volkswagen brand, but they also sell Skoda and Seat, which are not brands that are known over here, but are Volkswagen products, and of course Audi. So they're huge in Europe and very powerful. In the United States, they had trouble, you know, getting beyond being just a niche brand.
Yeah. And then I guess in the 90s, because I remember in Vancouver, everybody was driving at one point in the late 90s, early 2000s, a Golf or a Jetta. Mm-hmm. Was that when there was a bit of a resurgence again with this company?
Yeah, the Jetta was always a pretty popular car, made in Mexico, by the way. And the Golf, I don't think, I'm originally from Vermont, so pretty close to Canada, but I don't think in the United States the Golf was ever quite as popular. And it was mostly the Jetta, I think, that was sort of a hit with the U.S. buyers. And then when they came out with the new Beetle, which was sort of an updated version of the Beetle,
yeah.
With a much more modern technology, that was a big hit in the United States, but it kind of ran out of steam after a while.
Now, you're talking to someone who doesn't drive, so you'll forgive me if these questions are inane. But
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wrote this book. It's definitely not written for car people.
No.
My editor, when he first asked me to write it, he said, "I'm not a car person. You got to write a book that I'll still want to read." So I really tried to write it. Not only you don't have to be a car person, you don't have to care about cars at all. It's a story about power and abuse of power and the environment and how people behave. It's
Yeah, it's a, it's
cars
a,
are just the platform.
Yeah, it's a terribly engaging book at that. But in terms of what Volkswagen decided to do in terms of fuel emissions, I mean, is diesel better than gas in that sense, than regular gasoline, if you will?
Gasoline is a lot easier to control the emissions. The advantage of diesel is that it's more fuel efficient because of the way a diesel motor works.
Mm.
More of the fuel is burnt more completely, and they get more energy out of a liter of or a gallon of fuel with diesel than with gasoline. So that's the big advantage. And in that sense, it's good for the climate because it produces less carbon dioxide, sort of contributes less to global warming.
Yeah.
But the problem with diesel is it burns at a very high temperature, so it's practically a nitrogen oxide factory. The nitrogen and oxide molecules fuse inside the engine, come out the tailpipe, and they have all sorts of nasty effects. And that's the big problem with diesel, is controlling that.
Yeah.
And it can be done, but it's not easy, and it's expensive.
Yeah. And so I guess the hook that Volkswagen had for the longest time was that their cars, burned low, the emissions were low, or that they were even green, right?
Yeah. Well, they had this huge clean diesel advertising campaign, both for Audi and Volkswagen, spent a lot of money on it. They bought ads during the Super Bowl, and it was really a big deal. And they were targeting these environmentally conscious buyers, the same people who might buy a Toyota Prius.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to a lot of people. I still get emails all the time from buyers who said, hey, I bought this car because I thought it was green, and I'm really mad that it wasn't. And that has made the whole thing more expensive for Volkswagen, because it wasn't just the cheating, but also that they sold it as clean, which turned it into a massive consumer fraud.
Yeah. Are the regulations for emissions in Europe different than those in the United States?
On paper, they're almost the same. The United States has stricter limits on nitrogen oxides, but the language of prohibiting cheating on emissions tests is almost identical. But the big difference is that in Europe there's lots of loopholes and there's no enforcement.
Mm.
It's up to, they set the rules at the European level, but it's up to each country to enforce them. And what you've seen is countries basically try to protect their domestic auto industries. And so Germany was not really enforcing the rules against Volkswagen. There's now accusations that Italy has not been enforcing the rules with Fiat. And so it's basically a mess. The enforcement in Europe was a farce.
Yeah.
And one of the big mistakes Volkswagen made was thinking that, not realizing how much different the situation was in the United States.
So I guess at the crux of the scandal with Volkswagen was that their vehicles were emitting, far more than they were supposed to.
Right.
And there was some software that would report lower emissions than it was reported or it was sold as. And so who discovered it? I guess was it for the first time? Was that at West Virginia?
Yeah. Well, Volkswagen had come up with a software that could tell when the car was in a testing garage, because they always tested the cars on rollers in a garage. And so the software, when it realized that was happening, it would turn up the emissions control so that the car looked really clean.
Mm.
And then what these people at West Virginia did, it's a team run by a guy named Dan Carter and a bunch of graduate students, and they had equipment that could test the cars on the road. So that's what they did. They had a grant from a nonprofit organization, and they took the cars out on the road and quickly saw that the emissions when the car was driving around normally were way, way higher than they were when it was tested in the lab.
Yeah. I guess most testing is done in a lab, I suppose, right?
Right. Just about all testing.
Yeah.
At least up till, now there's a lot of talk about doing more road testing, but all the testing took place in the lab, and not only that, but the test itself was the parameters, the simulated driving cycle that they used, it was all public knowledge. So it was kind of like a test where you already know the answers. So naturally there was a big temptation for the car makers to cheat.
Yeah, and so you tell in the book the story of the management of the company throughout these years up to this point, and it's fascinating to see just how the management style in a corporation certain personalities can affect how the sort of work that the people at the front line do. So how many people knew this, Jack? Did this go to the top of the Volkswagen chain, if you will?
Well, we don't really have the smoking gun that takes it all the way to the top, all the way to the management board level. We know that right up to the level below management board, below the top people, there was a lot of discussion, emailing, PowerPoint presentations which describe the software. Volkswagen has insisted that this information never made it to the top management, and we don't have any proof to the contrary at the moment. You do have to ask yourself how it would be possible for this type of thing to be installed in 11 million cars worldwide over a period of almost a decade, and the word never gets to the top management. But at the moment, there's no clear indication. The investigations are still going on, and the German prosecutors have searched the offices of the chief executive, and they've said he's a suspect in a related securities case where the accusation is that the top management didn't fulfill their duty to tell shareholders about a big risk that was coming.
Yeah. I guess people who knew would probably say that there was a climate or a culture within Volkswagen that sort of encouraged the sort of malfeasance. In your reporting, in your investigations, is that the sense you get? Because, I mean, when you go through the history of this company, there's a lot of controversy in terms of, the scandal in terms of some of the managers going the 80s and 90s, right?
Yeah. They had a history of scandals. There was a big corporate espionage scandal in the early 90s, Volkswagen accused of stealing secrets from GM. And then in the mid-2000s, there was a scandal where the head of personnel was found to have been supplying prostitutes for labor leaders to keep them happy and compliant. Mm-hmm. And I think what was notable about those was that afterward, nothing really much changed. You didn't get a sense that management was all that outraged. You know, they always found some lower-ranking guy to take the fall. If you're an employee working in this company and you're observing the behavior of the people above you, you're definitely going to get the impression that these types of things are not really that big a deal. And so Volkswagen has even admitted there was a culture of rule-breaking. And so when they ran into an engineering problem, when they realized they couldn't make these cars compliant with the U.S. rules, it's not surprising that they then figured out an illegal way to get around it.
So there are lessons in your book, Faster, Higher, Farther, in terms of corporate leadership, let alone car manufacturing. Have you noticed in the several months, the year or more since all this broke, a change in sort of the corporate climate at Volkswagen and other car manufacturers, say?
They say that Volkswagen says it's changing its culture. You know, it's hard to tell whether it's real or not. I'm a little skeptical because it's really the same group of people. I mean, the chief executive, Winterkorn, left after the scandal came about, but there's still... the top management is still dominated by people who have been at the company for a long time, and in some cases were in pretty high-ranking positions when the whole cheating was taking place. So I think you have to ask whether it's really possible to change the culture of a company without also changing the top management. Another bad sign was that they hired a German Supreme Court take over compliance and culture change, and she lasted a little over a year and wound up leaving. So you get a feeling this is a very tough company to change, so I think it's definitely too early to say that they've turned over a new leaf. As far as the rest of the industry, I'm not really sure. I'm not sure that it's really provoked a lot of soul-searching elsewhere in the car industry. It certainly put people on notice that you better be pretty careful with emissions and not get caught cheating. Whether it's provoked a big culture change, I don't really see that so far.
Yeah, and so it's hurt Volkswagen. Obviously, you mentioned earlier that the sales have declined. With all the fines, the settlements, and the sort, I mean, was there ever a possibility that Volkswagen could go bankrupt?
I don't think they're financially, it's still a very strong company. They have lots of cash. You know, they're still selling a lot of cars, even though it's been flat. I don't think that's an immediate problem. I think the bigger problem is that this is really a time of transformation in the auto industry, and they need that the money that they've been spending on settlements, $22 billion in the United States alone, and then there was also a pretty big settlement in Canada. That's money that they really need to be spending on research and development and preparing for a future when cars are self-driving and probably running on batteries. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of handicapping them during this big transformation. It's going to take a while for that to play out, and I don't think imminently there's no danger that they're going to go bankrupt.
What hurts a company like Volkswagen in a scandal like this more? Is it the governments, the regulators, you know, breathing down their necks and fining them, and say, or is it the consumer backlash? I mean, you have a lady who I believe she was from Vermont, who specifically bought a car, an environmentalist, sort of someone thinking green in her daily habits, feeling hurt and duped that she bought a Volkswagen under the pretense that it was clean. I mean, is there a difference there in terms of what hurts Volkswagen more, the public backlash versus, say, a government punishing them, say?
Yeah, I think it's the bigger danger is with the customers. And that lady you mentioned, indeed, she was from Vermont, an environmental activist, and kind of typical of the type of people that I heard a lot from who really thought they were buying a clean car, and it's part of their whole self-image, and they were, you know, pretty mad to find out that wasn't true. And if you look at the $22 billion that Volkswagen's paying in the United States, $15 billion of that is part of the consumer class action. So that right there tells you what's been the most expensive. The fines and penalties in as part of the government action was less than $5 billion.
Yeah.
So it's really the consumer backlash. And plus, you know, you pay the government fine, okay, then it's over, you're done. Consumers, you have to win back their trust, and that's not easy at all.
And how has Volkswagen acted? I mean, you mentioned that they've paid out these settlements in the United States. What's happening in Europe? Is there a difference in how they're reacting to this problem there?
Well, in Europe, the legal system is much less friendly to the consumer. Most countries don't have class action suits like they do in the United States. Britain has kind of a form of class action, but if you're in Germany, you have to sue Volkswagen pretty much by yourself. And so it's much harder to get compensated. Plus, the European rules are much laxer than in the United States, so it's harder to prove that Volkswagen did anything bad. So I don't think they're going to have to pay $22 billion to consumers in Europe, but they do have some big risks. One is that shareholders are suing, saying that the management didn't fulfill its duties to tell them what was going on. And that's an area of law where it is fairly easy to sue in Europe, and that could cost Volkswagen another $10 billion or something. Plus, it's just a huge distraction. I can't even imagine how many lawyers Volkswagen is employing to defend itself, it's got to be in the thousands. So it's all very expensive and distracting from the core business of building cars.
Yeah, and you mentioned a moment ago in terms of all these settlements that that's money being diverted away from research and innovation. So from your look of things, I mean, is Volkswagen undertaking anything, say, innovative in the near future in terms of how they make their cars?
They're trying. You know, they're certainly aware of this risk, and I think they're serious about trying to deal with it. They say they're going to become an electric car company. They're promising to introduce a whole lot of new models. They're saying there's going to be a high-performance Porsche that you can recharge in 15 minutes. So I think they're serious about that. But of course, it's all a question of execution, whether they can pull it off. They're trying to invest also in some car sharing types of services. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not just worried about Tesla or Google self-driving cars. They're also worried about Uber and companies that, you know, may change the way that people drive, maybe make people think they don't really need to own cars anymore. So Volkswagen's trying. They definitely recognize the risk. But if you look at the history of Silicon Valley and technology, there's an awful lot of old industries that have been completely laid to waste once the Silicon Valley people focused on that industry, and that's definitely something that could happen, not just to Volkswagen, but all the big car makers.
And from your look of the history of Volkswagen, do you see them, say, attuned to change or can withstand change quickly?
It's a very big company. The other handicap they have is that it's basically company controlled by the workers. The state of Lower Saxony, where Volkswagen is located, owns 20%. Plus, in all German companies, the workers have half the seats on the supervisory board.
Mm.
So at Volkswagen, they have not only the half seats, but then they have two more seats that are held by the state of Lower Saxony, which vote with the workers. So basically, the company is controlled by the workers. So not surprisingly, it's hard to lay people off, hard to cut costs. Volkswagen has a lot more people building the same number of cars as Toyota. Volkswagen has like 600,000 employees. I think Toyota is less than 300,000. So they have a big efficiency gap, and it's going to be hard to address that with the ownership control structure that they have.
Do you live full-time in Germany?
Yes, I do. I've lived there actually since 1994, working for different media, previously Business Week magazine, and then since 2010, the New York Times.
Yeah, and so did you speak German?
Yes, absolutely, and I couldn't have written this book without being able to speak German.
So being there, I mean, are you able to I mean, from my read of the book, you're able to talk to a lot of people. And you talk to you have sources throughout, right?
Yes, and it's essential in that situation to speak German. I mean, most educated people in Germany speak some English, but they're certainly a lot happier to talk to you if you can speak their language.
Yeah.
That was certainly, I think, an essential part of the recording process.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating book, and it's something that we followed obviously in the news. But to have it in a book in front of you, and to have the context as you provide in terms of the history, it's such an engaging book. Congratulations on it, Jack, and good luck with it.
But Joe, thanks very much for your interest. I appreciate it.
The book is called Faster, Higher, Farther, The Volkswagen Scandal. W.W. Norton is its publisher. Jack Ewing, its author, joined me on the line from New York City and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.